May it please the Court, good morning. Kent Robinson, appearing for the United States, the appellant in this matter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for
rebuttal. We'll try to help you, but please keep track.
Thank you, Your Honor. The District Court's orders suppressing identity evidence of the defendant in this case are contrary to rulings of the Supreme Court and this circuit. The Supreme Court and this circuit have repeatedly held that a defendant may not challenge either the presence of his body in the courtroom or the introduction of identification evidence merely because he was subject to an unlawful arrest. This court has repeatedly applied those principles in the context of the prosecution of illegal aliens to hold that the defendant's identity may not be suppressed. And in particular, in United States versus Parga Rosas, the court held that a post-indictment fingerprinting does not implicate the Fourth Amendment, and that those post-indictments...
Can I read you the language from Vargas Rosas? It's very short. It's at the end. Because the fingerprints were not taken for investigatory purposes, but for the sole purpose of proving Vargas Rosas' identity, the Fourth Amendment is not implicated.
That's
the question
correct.
Here is whether they were taken for investigatory purposes.
There's two different sets of fingerprints we're talking about, Your Honor. There's the fingerprints taken at the time of the arrest, and there's the fingerprints that I sought to obtain by a motion to compel a fingerprint exemplar.
Oh, I see. So are you questioning then? Let's talk about the fingerprints that were first taken. Are those, in your view, those fingerprints were also properly taken, or were those investigatory fingerprints?
In my view, they were also properly taken because they were not investigatory fingerprints. Even if they were investigatory, I think under Guzman Bruno, it doesn't make any difference.
Okay. But can I talk about the first fingerprints then? First off, I'm trying to figure out what we're supposed to do with the district judge's finding that this was a race-based stop, a race-based arrest. Is that a factual finding?
Obviously, the historical facts are fact-based, Your Honor, but the Gonzalez-Rivera, I believe, is the case that sets up the race-based arrest standard. It holds that whether the facts meet that standard is a de novo question. Now, that one of my arguments is, of course, that even looking at the historical facts acknowledged by the district court, there's no basis for concluding that this was a race-based stop.
What if the district judge says, I've listened to the testimony, I conclude that the subjective motivation of the officer, that is to say, this is what was in the officer's mind, was that he stopped because of race. Is that a fact-based thing to which we should defer, or is that not a fact-based thing to which we should defer?
Whether it's race-based is not a fact, is not ultimately a factual determination.
Yeah, but I'm asking a slightly different question. If the judge decides this is what was in the officer's head, this is what motivated the officer, is that similarly not a factual determination?
I would have two responses. First, subjective inquiry isn't even supposed to take place in the Fourth Amendment context. But let me address specifically your question.
But that may be your final answer. That is to say, motivation has no place here.
Right. That is one of my answers.
Yeah.
I don't think on the facts of this case that the court can just look at the court's statement that this is race-based. And maybe that's an abuse of discretion standard, because there's too much else here justifying what the officer did. And these are facts that the court acknowledged. It's beyond dispute that the defendant was identified as a drug dealer. It's beyond dispute that he was in the company of a prior customer of his. It's beyond dispute that he lied about his age, his identity, and the fact that he was a prior drug dealer. Those are all the things that the officer testified to, led him to the conclusion that he had probable cause. Now, he may have been wrong about that.
Yeah. Let me tell you where my problem comes with your case and where my problem don't come. I have no problem with the stop. Wren says, you know, you may have something else in mind, but if there's a traffic violation, you can stop. I have no trouble with the questioning. But where my problem comes is after he's gotten the answers to the questions, and the characterization that you've given of the answers is, I think, within the boundaries of fair play, but it is a sort of a characterization. She testifies, yes, once, some time ago, she purchased drugs from him. She testifies that she's an occasional heroin user, now does methadone. At the time that he puts Mr. Hernandez under arrest. He's not found a syringe. I think he finds the syringe later. He finds no drugs on the defendant. So all we have is testimony from a woman he's about to let go that at one time in the past he did sell drugs. He arrests him for sale of drugs or attempted sale of drugs, but there are no drugs there. There's no testimony from anybody that he's now doing it. But in your view, that arrest is nonetheless sufficiently justified.
Well, the court has referenced only those facts which are not in dispute. There were additional facts that the officer relied on. Notably, he testified that another officer had said he saw the defendant engaging in a swallowing motion. I haven't relied on that here because it's a factor that the district court discounted.
The district court, as a matter of fact, put that to one side, saying that was never in the report and we don't have any testimony from the officer who said that. Well, all we have is this officer saying he heard the officer say that.
That's correct. The court discounted it. The court has very accurately summarized what might be seen as the shortcoming of the probable cause determination of the agent at that time. But that's an entirely separate question from whether this was a race-based arrest.
I understand that.
And indeed, I think the factors that the court has listed, while they may not rise to the level of probable cause, certainly overcome a burden as set forth in the race-based cases of showing that the arrest was for, I think what those cases say is that when the arrest was solely because of the defendant's race, then there may be a race-based arrest, but I just don't think you can reach that standard.
I've fully made up my mind, and obviously I can't speak for my colleagues because our custom is we really don't discuss these cases until after argument and conference, so I'm clearly not speaking for them, and I'm not sure even quite where I am on this, but my tentative inclination is to agree with you that this is not, there's not enough here to find that it's race-based. But my tentative inclination is to find that there wasn't sufficient cause for the arrest, which is quite a different proposition from finding that it's race-based.
I agree. Even if the court concludes that there wasn't sufficient probable cause for the arrest, I still think then clearly the Ninth Circuit cases, Guzman, Bruno, among others, hold that the post-arrest fingerprints should not be suppressed because the defendant's identity and evidence of his identity can be suppressed.
Now, again, we've got two sets of fingerprints. I'm not sure which one we're talking about. Yes, there was no probable cause for the arrest. The first fingerprints, I think, were investigatory. Would you agree with that, if there's no probable cause for the arrest?
No, I wouldn't agree with that, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because I don't think that they...
Because at that point, they have no evidence of the crime for which he's being arrested. At that point, he's just trying to figure out, okay, what do I have here? It sounds like an investigation to me.
What do I have, or who do I have? That's the problem I have with the record.
Yeah, well, that's another way of saying the
same
thing.
Well, I'm not sure that it is, because my concern is the officer testified that he thought that Mr. Hernandez had lied to him about what his true name was. And so I want to explore with you for a minute whether the booking photograph, fingerprints that were taken were also taken for the purpose of trying to establish with certainty who it was that they had arrested.
Of course they were, and that's exactly what the officer said.
If that's the case, then can they be taken for both purposes? And how do we reconcile a dual reason for purposes of establishing his true identity, but also because the officer testified that he thought this guy must be wanted for something based on the way he behaved in the field? Can't we also conclude that the prints were taken for an investigatory purpose, to find out whether he was wanted for some other crime?
Well, I think the term fingerprints for an investigatory purpose derives from Davis, and that's a circumstance in which a defendant was picked up and fingerprinted solely for investigative purposes. And that brings us back to the mere shortfall of probable cause doesn't convert any ensuing fingerprinting to an investigatory fingerprinting. The officer could have had a legitimate belief. It may, on subsequent analysis, fall short of probable cause, but that doesn't mean that every ensuing fingerprinting becomes an investigatory fingerprinting.
Well, I guess we have to just figure out what do we mean by investigatory fingerprinting. Let's assume, although I think you're contesting it, but let's assume for the purpose of the questions that the arrest was without probable cause and therefore an improper arrest. So the officer's not supposed to be holding him. During that time, while he's not supposed to be holding him, he compels fingerprints. Now, in ordinary language, he's investigating. That is to say, he's trying to figure out, in my term, what he has, in Judge Tallman's terms, who he has. He's trying to figure out both things. He's investigating. What else is he doing?
Well, you're assuming that the officer was acting with knowledge that he didn't have probable cause. I don't think a routine booking fingerprint, and this is what the case law holds.
Whether he knows he has probable cause or doesn't know he has probable cause, I don't know that that's relevant. That is to say, he either does or he does not. I'm assuming, and we're assuming for purposes of the question, that he does not.
Fine.
And why is he taking these fingerprints? Well, because he wants to find things out. He wants to find out who is this guy.
No, he's taking the fingerprints because he's arrested him and because the routine processing following an arrest involves fingerprinting.
But at that time, when he's taking those things, he has nothing on this guy.
Well, that's not what he thinks at the time.
But the district court finds that he has nothing on this guy.
That's true. But
the district judge takes it even further and says this is a race-based arrest. I'm not sure I'm quite willing to go that far. But the district judge says he knows he's got nothing. Well, he knows he's got an Hispanic. That's what he knows.
Doesn't he have to go, though? The district judge has got to declare that this is an egregious race-based violation in order to get around our case law that says even if there was no probable cause to make the arrest and all other evidence or fruits of the arrest would normally be suppressed, the one thing that does not get suppressed is evidence of the identity of the person, which in this case comes from his fingerprints. That's the only way we're able to determine who he is.
That's correct.
So how do you deal with Davis then?
The officer arresting any defendant has and society has a legitimate and a compelling need to take the defendant's fingerprints at that point, not because they're investigating possible other crimes, but because it is a routine consequence of arresting somebody. And that's the distinction between what happened in Davis. Those people were picked up just for the purpose of getting their fingerprints. They weren't arrested. They were scooped up and fingerprinted. That's far different from the legitimate and routine taking of fingerprints in the post-arrest context.
Well, what do you mean they weren't arrested in Davis? They were picked up involuntarily and their fingerprints were taken. That sounds like an arrest to me.
Of course, Your Honor. I mean, the
might have been an improper arrest, but that's what we got here, at least under the premise. I understand you're not conceding improper
arrest. The law enforcement officers in Davis didn't purport to be arresting or to be acting with probable cause in that case.
But if that's the analysis, if you say the magic words, I'm arresting you, even though you have no probable cause to arrest, and it's an improper arrest, that makes the fingerprinting proper, whereas if you just pick them up and say, I'm not arresting you, but please stay in the back of this car until I take your fingerprints, that's different?
You have exactly identified the question, what should the standard be for applying Davis? And I believe the standard should be Davis applies only when the sole purpose for taking the fingerprints is for investigatory purposes, not when there is a arrest which the officer premises on probable cause, even if that probable cause showing is later found to be insufficient. And here, once again, there was enough to support what the officer did that it shouldn't cause the application of an extraordinary remedy like Davis. But I would like to turn to the second set of fingerprints.
Well, do that, because... And let's see how essential what we've been talking about is to what the court ultimately does here. Let's assume the three appeals.
Correct.
The suppression, criminal prosecution, supervised release, and then the exemplar for INS purposes. Suppose that we say this first suppression motion was correct, purely investigation. It's correct. What do we do? What's our judgment on the three appeals?
Well, that finding would uphold the first suppression order.
To that extent, but the case hadn't been tried yet.
That's correct.
And if you have a good fingerprint, then you don't care about that suppression, but because you've got that to introduce... at your trial.
You're absolutely right.
So if all we did was vacate and send it back, and you can use a fingerprint, either supervised release or an exemplar, it doesn't matter to you.
Except the district court told me I couldn't get the exemplar, and that's the...
Well, I understand.
That's the other
notice
of appeal.
We'd have to reverse that.
Right. That's... I think...
Would that make you happy?
It would make me happy indeed, Your Honor, and I think it would largely...
Because this first point really doesn't matter.
It really doesn't matter if I get the subsequent fingerprints and if I am permitted to introduce the defendant's immigration file and prior records.
Well, that's entirely different matter. There's been no finding on that. No reason why you couldn't.
Well, the finding is a taint, right? Under the current district court order, he's essentially said you can never take fingerprints from this man.
That's correct.
Because it all flows from the initial illegal arrest.
That's different.
Yeah. Now, we have lots of branches. This is quite an interesting case. It's almost like a law school exam because of the various little things that might happen.
Right.
Let me pursue Judge Rievele's line of questioning. Let's assume, and I understand you're not conceding, you're just...
Yes.
Let's assume that the fingerprints are purely investigatory. So the first set of fingerprints taken has to be suppressed.
Right.
Let's assume further that only because he got those fingerprints the first time around, the investigatory fingerprints, that got him to his immigration file information.
Yes.
Because I think there's a pretty direct chain. If he didn't have those fingerprints, he didn't get that stuff.
That's correct.
The foundation for the criminal trial is the immigration records that he obtained.
That's correct.
I'm willing to go right along with you. I think if someone is properly at trial, a fingerprint exemplar can be compelled. But what if the only way you get him to trial is by the use of these immigration documents, which were obtained through the fingerprints that he shouldn't have taken?
The Ninth Circuit has addressed that exact issue, Your Honor.
In what case?
Hunsalapa. And I believe Orozco is the other one. And what the court there held was that the mere fact that an illegal arrest leads the authorities to the pre-existing immigration files does not call for suppression of those pre-existing files.
Now, I'm sorry. I need to read those cases. Are they cited in your briefs? I've run a lot of cases in connection with this
yes.
appeal, but I've not read those.
They are cited, Your Honor.
Okay. Sometimes there are just too many cases out there for me to read beforehand.
I suffer from the same problem, so my fingers are poised.
Hunsalapa is at 575 F second
775. I'm sorry, 575 F second
735.
735. Hunsalapa.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I'm at page 738 of the opinion, where it says the mere fact that the Fourth Amendment illegality directs attention to a particular suspect does not require exclusion of evidence subsequently unearthed from independent sources. And the specific issue addressed there is whether...
Well, the word sounds like independent. We can read the case. What's the second case?
Well, if I could finish with
that. I'm sorry.
It specifically says, no sanction shall be applied when an illegal arrest only leads to discovery of the man's identity, and that merely leads to the official file. The file can be used so far as relevant.
Okay, that sounds relevant. And your other case is?
It is... I believe that case is cited later in
That's okay. Take your time. It's my lack of reading that's responsible for this delay.
I believe the case, Your Honor, and I'm doing this on recollection, is Orozco Rico.
How do I spell all those line names?
Orozco-Rico, 589 F second 433.
589 F second, and what was the last number?
433. Cited in my brief.
Okay. Okay, good. Thank you. Now I will make sure to read those cases. So your view is that even though it might well be true that taking those fingerprints led to the immigration file, under our case law, that doesn't matter.
Okay. That's correct.
I'm with you.
And it also doesn't matter that the taking of those fingerprints lead to the subsequent obtaining of an exemplar. The same authority applies, and I think that takes us back.
Well, I think you got there, or I get you there by another way. That is to say, if the obtaining of the immigration file is permitted, and therefore we're properly in trial, the exemplar can be compelled.
Yes, as long as the body is present in court, the physical characteristics of the body are appropriately brought before the trier of the fact, and that means taking a fingerprint exemplar. I think the court tried to craft an exemption to that rather simple principle based on its race-based finding. But I do not think that even if this was a race-based arrest, and obviously I don't concede that it is, that such an exception can be crafted.
Okay, thank you. And we'll give you a minute or so in response. We'll use up all your time, but we'll give you some back.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you very much. My name is Paul Papik. I represent Mr. Ortiz-Hernandez. As the court noted, this is a complicated case with many levels. It seemed that the court was not inclined to discuss the probable cause finding, and I'll skip over that except to mention a comment the judge made in the previous argument that wouldn't your case be a whole lot stronger if this happened at noon rather than at 4 a.m.? This happened at noon. This happened in a very crowded district of southeast Portland, in a filled McDonald's. Everything about this case appeared to be innocent behavior.
Mr. Papik, I'll give you the win on probable cause.
All right.
None.
No,
okay?
Probable cause.
No probable cause.
Well, let's,
okay,
let's,
but before you sit down,
no, I'm not sitting down.
Let's go to my next level of concern, which is, where does the district court find support for the suppression of the defendant's identity when this is a continuing criminal offense? Every minute that your client remains in the United States, he's continuing to commit the crime of illegal reentry.
That he's in court.
That he's in court. I mean, I guess what bothers me about what the district judge tried to do here, it was almost tantamount to saying to the government, I find that there was no probable cause to establish the arrest, and he gets a good, a safe conduct pass. You got to put him on the next INS bus to the border, and nobody from the sovereign can touch him. Even though every minute he's riding the bus to the border, he's continuing to commit a federal criminal violation. And he's saying to the government, you can't investigate and prosecute that.
Are you sure he doesn't get a safe conduct pass to stay here?
Well, maybe he gets a safe conduct pass to stay here.
That's really, I think, ultimately what is of concern if we uphold what the district court did.
Well, I suspect that's not an uncommon result in application of the exclusionary rule generally.
I can't think of any other. We certainly suppress evidence that makes it impossible for the government to prosecute a historical crime. What makes this one different is that it's a continuing crime.
Well, the issue, as I understand it, Your Honor, first of all, is there has never been a suppression of the body in this case, nor is the body of Mr. Ortiz-Hernandez currently suppressed.
But
he's
in jail. Suppressing any ability to prove who he is.
That's not true. He's suppressing tainted evidence. If the government has other independent source evidence, and those are your cases of Guzman Bruno and Parga Rosas, in both of those cases, if you recall, the officers approached the defendant, and before any illegality, asked either, what is your name? And Mr. Guzman Bruno said, Mr. Guzman Bruno, or Mr. Parga Rosas handed him a green card saying, I'm Mr. Parga Rosas. And the judge there, in both cases, said the subsequent arrest and the subsequent search of those gentlemen were illegal, but the initial identification was from an independent source, and so therefore it was appropriate to gather further information about the identity because they had established that independent source.
But there would be nothing improper. Let's forget about the illegal arrest for a minute. There would be nothing improper in issuing a grand jury subpoena or a court order requiring Mr. Hernandez to come into the courthouse and provide a set of fingerprints. You agree? Under any other circumstances?
Under other circumstances.
That would be perfectly appropriate. If an INS investigator suspected
that he might be in the United States illegally without probable cause or reasonable suspicion, he could get a court order saying, provide us with fingerprints.
Yes, generally, that's correct.
And what the district court is doing here is saying, from this point on into the future, I'm not going to let the government do that. You cannot get a set of fingerprints from this man.
No,
It's suppressed.
That, that may be the practical effect at this point. I'm not sure that's the court's broader ruling, because in the government's request for a fingerprint exemplar, they provided the court with no information that they had an independent source to establish who this person was. And so the fingerprint exemplar was simply a way to avoid the suppression ruling, the taint.
I don't see how you could ever avoid that taint.
Well, once easily. I mean, very frequently we have agents, INS agents, police officers, who make arrests, and they say, well, I know him. He lived here before. That's Mr. Ortiz Hernandez. Well, if they brought a person in the court to say, I can identify him, I know who he is, I think they would have arguable evidence for independent source by which they could now present to Judge Redden a request for a handwriting exemplar and say, this isn't tainted by what we did in the improper race-based or not race-based search, and grant that exemplar. The problem here is the government hasn't done that, and you're correct in assuming perhaps they can't, and perhaps they are going to be foreclosed from any prosecution, but it's because of the taint of the initial stop and directing it forward to their subsequent activity. All they're trying to do is avoid the results of the suppression motion to gather evidence to prosecute, and this is simply an extension of Wong Sun that says that can't be done, and Wong Sun cites fingerprint cases as part of the exclusionary rule.
The problem is it's swallowing the rule that the court never loses jurisdiction over the body of the person. The question is, who is this person, and how do we know who he is? And the only two ways I know to do it are either through fingerprints or through DNA. I mean, you say somebody could come in and say, I know that's Mr. Ortiz Hernandez, but I'm not sure that would be sufficient, because what you need to do is to match the fingerprints that are in the A file, well, so that we know that this is the Ortiz Hernandez who was deported previously.
But it seems to me, Your Honor, that there are a number of ways to prove identity, assuming, first of all, that we're dealing with a legal reentry prosecution. I mean, this did begin as an alleged drug charge where identity may be insignificant if they wanted to charge John Doe. But on the illegal reentry charge, if somebody came into court and said, I know this to be Jose Ortiz Hernandez, and I know it from looking at him standing here, and I know it from before the taint, it seems to me then the government can make application for the immigration file to test picture versus picture or thumbprint versus thumbprint, then do further testing. But they can't use the information gathered as part of the illegal, I believe, race-based arrest that taints that first identification where the officer sitting in his office is really trolling around trying to find out, is there something I can charge this guy with? Because I sure don't have much here.
Trolling around trying to find out, is there something I can charge him with? Or trolling around to find out, who is this guy?
Well,
I don't believe the name he gave me. He lied to me.
Well, the court found, and I think he had a factual basis for finding, that the officer indicated he believed, although we don't know why, that he was wanted for something and he was looking for something to charge him with. He called the INS to investigate because, hey, he's Hispanic. Maybe he's here illegally. And he sought for his fingerprints to see whether they would come back either with a warrant attached or his identity would be something different.
But you have to know his identity in order to find out whether or not he's wanted for anything. That's the problem.
Well, I think the problem is that the discovery of identity in this case flows directly from the tainted arrest, and they want to use the fact that they arrested him, that they searched him without probable cause, that they did that, as Judge Redden found, on baseless and unfounded grounds, and he concluded race-based, to then simply avoid the suppression ruling and say, well, we can always get fingerprints. I think the case law is pretty clear that when we talk about this issue of the body never being suppressed, we're talking about a jurisdictional matter. And the case law says that if you go out and you kidnap somebody totally illegally and bring them into court, and you've got a case against them that preexisted the taint of that kidnapping and arrest, you can try them. The body's here, try them. But it doesn't mean you can go and kidnap somebody, bring them back in a court, and say, now let's prove our case. Let's get his fingerprints, let's do some DNA, because that comes directly from the taint of the arrest. Unless the government can establish the independent source, And I think that's what the case law in the area says, and that's what makes Davis and Hayes vibrant here, because Guzman, Bruno, and Pargas Rosa have independent sources. Hayes and Davis deal with the question of investigating criminal activity, and that's what they were doing with Mr. Ortiz Hernandez. Instead of having the crime first, let's find who did it. Here they have the person, let's find a crime. I'm sorry, Judge Fletcher, you had a question.
I'd like you to respond, if you can, to these cases I haven't read yet that I think I better read. Husalapa and Orozco.
Yes. I think, Your Honor, that those cases dealt with and moved forward or precede the court's findings in Guzman Bruno and Parga Rosa, and they do deal with independent source evidence that is discussing the fact that they have something in the first place that's not tainted. I think part of the problem in this area of the law is there has been some confusion in the courts and in talking about the idea of you can never suppress the body, meaning somehow you can never suppress identification evidence. And I think we're dealing with two different concepts. We're dealing with the jurisdictional concept of having a person and you don't suppress him, and gathering evidence, getting ready for trial.
Well, it comes awful close to that, because I can't conceive of a way from this point on that the government could free itself from the taint of the arrest in order to bring a motion for exemplars that Judge Redden would grant.
I can't either. That's why I think I win.
Well, except that your client continues to violate the law, and you acknowledge that we don't lose jurisdiction over the body, but the practical effect is that he can't be prosecuted for a crime that he is continuing to commit. Well, and if that's the law, then there's something wrong with our law. That can't be the right answer.
I think it is the right answer, and there's another reason to get there.
The law doesn't have to make sense?
No, the law should make sense. But there's the other reason to get there, I think, and I know the courts had some trouble with that, so let me address this, is the court's conclusion that I think is amply supported by the record, that this was a race-based arrest, that all of the assumptions here were racial. I mean, as Judge Redden put it, and if I can quote him from the record, it's hard to envision the arrest and treatment of the defendant had he been a non-Hispanic, walking to and using a public telephone outside a large public grocery store in the middle of the afternoon, et cetera, et cetera. I think when you get to the notion, and I don't think this needs to be the answer, but another way to look at this is that if this is a race-based arrest, you have what the courts have found, what this court has found to be egregious constitutional violations. And when you have egregious constitutional violations, you have significant remedies. And the remedy in this case is precisely that perhaps this man doesn't get prosecuted for illegal reentry. I mean, the cases that raise the egregious violations, or Horhahi and Gonzalez-Rivera, talk specifically about in the INS context.
So he's just been the recipient of a judicial grant of lawful permanent residency, because he can never be prosecuted for illegal reentry.
Well, Judge Redden recognized, and of course this question is lurking and not yet mature, but I suppose that the question arises, what happens, and if this case is dismissed, he goes off to INS and is deported. And presumably, at least Judge Redden anticipated that deportation would occur. There's also the question that we haven't addressed here of a separate matter of a supervised release violation hearing, for which there is a remedy of a potential couple of years in prison where...
Let me ask this in terms of practical consequences. Assume for a moment that we find we do not agree with the finding of race-based,
yes,
but that we do find no probable cause, we do find that the initial fingerprints were taken as investigatory fingerprints,
yes,
and therefore should be suppressed. I take it that that means that the deportation proceeding can go forward. This is our rule, is that you don't suppress in a deportation, or now it's called a removal proceeding. Unless it's egregious and race-based, but I just took that out of the hypothesis.
Correct. If you take it out of the process...
So he's going to get... So if that's what we do, he gets deported.
Yes.
So he's out of here. He does not get a green card.
No.
He's gone.
Correct.
What was he prosecuted for criminally? It wasn't for being here. It was for having done illegal reentry.
Correct.
That is to say, he was not being prosecuted for you are here today, he's prosecuted for how he got here.
He's coming across the border without permission after deportation and commission
of an aggravated felony. He's prosecuted for a prior illegal act.
Yes.
No, no, no. The element is, and he is present right now, today,
well, that's an
in
element
the
of the
United
crime.
States but without the permission of the Attorney General.
But the commission, in fact, was the entry across the border at a time in the past. But
the crime continues because of the fact that he does not now possess the permission of the Attorney General to remain here.
That's correct.
Yeah, well, that's being found. they're different crimes. He's clearly illegal and committing crimes as he stays here.
But it's the same crime. It's a violation of Section 1326 of Title 8, right?
Yes.
There's only one criminal offense that we're talking about.
As I recall, he may have been charged with three, which is standard under our government's indictment, but that's not relevant to the discussion. They're all Title 8 charges.
Is it really your position that there is no way that they could pick him up and prosecute him for criminal entry or being found illegally in this country at this point, now that they've found out who he is this way?
Well, I don't know that there's no way. I think I can hypothesize a number of ways. What I'm saying is from what I've heard from the government, and I think the reason we're here instead of in trial on either the drug or the illegal reentry is they don't think there's another way and that they need a fingerprint exemplar because they have no other independent source.
At this time, they have no other independent source.
As far as I know, I mean, if they would, we'd be in trial, and I'm sure Mr. Ortiz-Hernandez, who's been in custody a year and a half now, would love to resolve this. But no, I think what the problem is that in this case, different from Guzman Bruno and Parga Rosa, where when encountered, the defendant admitted his name or handed a card with his true name and gave the government independent source evidence that allowed them then to go get trial evidence by way of fingerprints. It didn't happen here. Mr. Ortiz-Hernandez gave a different name, and they did not know who he was until they took him into custody and did an investigative fingerprinting process, as Judge Redden found out who he was, and then said, let's avoid the taint of the illegal search, race-based or not, by just sidestepping it with the fingerprint exemplar. And Judge Redden said, well, you can't do that. I mean, this is all Wong's son.
What happens if he has his there's a parole revocation hearing or supervised release violation? He's put back in jail. Do they fingerprint people when they come into jail?
I assume they do.
Bingo, got him.
I'm sorry?
Bingo, you got him. Meaning, that sounds like a legitimate fingerprint. That sounds like they got their independent source.
Well, possible. I mean, we could be back here again arguing
except,
the extension of that.
Except that you're arguing that they can't use his fingerprints in the suppression.
All I'm arguing, Your Honor, right now is that they cannot use the fingerprint that they gathered investigatorily after his arrest, and that the court is right in denying a fingerprint exemplar. The possibility that they may be back here, or we may be back here in a year when the Bureau of Prisons fingerprints him and the INS refers him back.
No, you're overlooking one salient fact here. The government wants to use his fingerprints to establish identity in the supervised release revocation hearing. Your position is they can't, because under Judge Redden's order, they can't use any evidence of his fingerprints against him, period, because it was race-based.
Independent or otherwise.
Exactly. Well, that is your position, is it not?
That will be my position. That's not where we're at here. As I recall, this is not a motion in limine pending hearing or trial in which the judge made a ruling about the exclusion of potential evidence. They asked for a handwriting exemplar. He denied it. That's it. They haven't brought forward...
Handwriting or fingerprint?
I'm sorry, fingerprint exemplar. And he denied it. They haven't brought forward and said, we're going to trial with his INS file. And here's a photograph we're going to use in the INS file. We haven't... And he hasn't excluded that. It just hasn't risen yet. It's not before us. It's just the fingerprint exemplar and the fingerprint taken shortly after the illegal arrest.
But just to follow, make sure my question was based upon a hypothesis. That is to say, the hypothesis being that we hold that there's no race-based arrest, but it was rather an arrest without probable cause. If that's so, the fingerprints that would be suppressed in the criminal trial can be introduced for the supervised release hearing, can't they?
I assume so.
The government can use them in the supervised release and the parole revocation hearing.
Sure, if the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply and
the
court so rules.
It does apply, but it's not race based. It's merely lack of probable cause. That is to say, the exclusionary rule does not operate.
Correct. It's our argument that it's the race-based point of the analysis that gets us into the supervised release violation.
But if you take away the race-based part and you just turn it into no probable cause and it's a garden variety Fourth Amendment violation, then you can introduce them, then you can revoke the parole, then they can fingerprint him when he goes back to prison. Bingo, independent source. That's not where we are now, but I'm trying to play this out. What's going to happen to this guy?
Well, I think you're right that we, under that ruling, we would go to a supervised release hearing without the exclusionary rule. They would use the prints. He would probably simply stipulate. He'd be sentenced to time. He would go off to the Bureau of Prison, or if his time's already up, he'd be sent to INS. And then we would see if they would re-fingerprint, say that was an independent source, and come back to court to prosecute.
Well, but it would go one step further, wouldn't it? Because if we find that it is not race-based, then the district court erred when it denied the government's motion for fingerprinting exemplar.
No, I disagree on that, Your Honor. I think there are two separate lines to get to the fingerprint exemplar. You can make the argument, and I think it's accurate to say, that a race-based violation of the Fourth Amendment deserves this kind of application exclusionary rule. But I believe, directly under the line of Hayes and Davis and the notion that they have no independent source, the taint of the illegal search, absent race-based analysis, the taint of the illegal search prevents them from gathering that evidence without showing some independent source to get there. And I think what the cases hold is they don't know who he is. Their evidence of identity is suppressed. They can't ask for that fingerprint evidence to prove it because it's tainted from the original stop. So I think using a independent source analysis or a race-based analysis, you get to the same result on the fingerprint exemplar.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Popak ran over, and we've saved a little time for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The taint argument we've just heard from the defense has been explicitly rejected. In United States versus Cruz, the Supreme Court held that the body of case law holding that the body can't be suppressed also means that the identifying characteristics of the body that are present in the courtroom cannot be suppressed.
And, well, what happens if they shouldn't be there in the courtroom at all because the evidence used to even bring the trial or bring the indictment was fruit of the poisonous tree?
Cruz specifically applies Wong Sung, applies the fruit of the poisonous tree analysis, and holds that the identifying characteristics of the defendant present in the courtroom are independent.
I've got the same problem, which is to say my own ignorance. United States versus Cruz is, I got it, you're at page 41 and 42 of your brief. Okay.
That's correct. And importantly, as interpreted by the Ninth Circuit in United States versus Humphreys, 636 F. 2nd, 1172.
You finally got a case I've read.
Well, the court there refers to Cruz and says a majority of the Supreme Court has held that the defendant's presence in the courtroom cannot be attacked as the fruit of an illegal arrest. And the context of that conversation was whether the defendant's physical characteristics could be used as part of in-court identification. And I think it's important to point out that I even offered to have the fingerprinting done in the courtroom in the presence of the jury at the time of trial to bring this case clearly within the holding of Humphrey. So the taint argument doesn't work. The only basis for the court's ruling would be if the court found this was a race-based stop, then the court would have to expand
the exclusion. But I'm quite familiar with the law. We all know this law, that you can arrest somebody illegally and bring him into court if you've already got evidence to try him. You can kidnap him. We know that.
Right.
Is that what the Cruz case is? That is to say, it's an illegal arrest, but they had evidence on it.
That's correct.
This is not a case where all they did. This is not a case of illegal arrest to bring him in to try him on evidence we already had. This is a case where the evidence we have that allowed the trial to go forward is, by hypothesis, illegally obtained.
I think what Cruz stands for, Your Honor, is that the fact that we can have the body in the courtroom means that that is independent of the illegality that brought him here. And that's it. That's what the Ninth Circuit said in Hunsalapo, and I had the chance to look at it while I was sitting down, and in fact, that is reiterated in the criminal context in Orozco Rico and all the ensuing cases that rely upon it. Unless the court wants me to address further whether there should be a race-based...
No, I think it's covered thoroughly in the briefs and in the argument. Thank both of you for a very good argument.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
The case of the United States versus Ortiz-Hernandez is now submitted. The last case on our argument calendar is Prudential Insurance Company versus, I'm not sure whether Bacon or Norton or both.
Please, the court. I'm Lynn Ashcroft.
Hang on just a second while we're setting up.
That's okay.
Oh, we forgot your co-counselor.